Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And it's time for an insect update. What's going on in the world of insects in our area of, in your area of the state? Our guest, PJ Leash, back with us, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We'll talk about, Japanese beetles. We can take a look at those elm zigzag sawflies and other things as well. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got an observation. Maybe you have a question about bugs in your area. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. PJ Leash, good to see you again. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Larry.
Let's start with Japanese beetles. How soon can we expect to see Japanese beetles?
Well, I think it's going to be a couple of weeks before we see our main push for these. They usually start emerging right around the 4th of July, give or take. And that can always shift a little bit. With insects, we can't really mark a firm calendar date. If you have an early warm spring, might shift things earlier or later, depending on conditions. In many years, though, I will hear my first reports right around now, kind of mid to later June. So I'm just waiting for those. I know they're probably starting to pop out maybe in some locations, especially if you had a south-facing hill that's just warming up in the sun a little bit more than other areas. So not here yet, but they will be popping out in a couple of weeks.
And they're fairly distinctive. I mean, you can tell one when you see one, I think, aren't
they? Oh, yeah. Yeah, they are. I mean, Japanese beetles, they're a type of scarab beetle, smaller than a May-June beetle or June bug, as a lot of folks call them. But they're close to half an inch long or so. They have a metallic sheen to the body, some coppery brown on the wings, otherwise a metallic green color. And along the side of their abdomen are these little tufts. It looks like hairs. As an entomologist, we call them seedy technically, but little tufts of hairs that are whitish. So very, very distinctive, although I will say there's another insect, the multicolored Asian lady beetle, that often folks seem to mix up those two names.
Mix those two up, yeah. So how are we in terms of spread across Wisconsin? Are they popping up everywhere in our state?
It's been interesting to watch, especially the last 3 to 5-ish years. So if we went back, say, 10, 15, 20 years, at that point in time, it was primarily an issue in southern Wisconsin.
Right.
I remember early 2000s or so, around 2010, west side of Madison, you could identify in August a linden tree from a mile away because it was completely brown because of feeding damage from it. The last few years, things have been relatively quiet in much of southern Wisconsin. I think part of that is due to some of the dry, droughtier conditions we've had. Could also be some other things, including some natural enemies. Maybe they are reaching kind of an equilibrium out in the ecosystem. The last couple years, though, most of my reports of high numbers of beetles and significant plant damage have been from the Highway 29 corridor, so like Eau Claire to Wausau to Green Bay. Also, I will say the Green Bay, Oshkosh, Sheboygan area, that triangular area, there's been some decent activity there as well. But otherwise, it's been more northern parts of the state. Wausau, Merrill, Minocqua, Rhinelander, Eagle River, even in northwestern Wisconsin up towards Spooner, we're seeing activity up there. Whereas 10, 20 years ago, we weren't really seeing them that part of the state. So definitely pushing their way northwards.
And understand that there is some biological control methods for Japanese beetles now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of options out there. And when it comes to management of Japanese beetles, in my mind, there's really a number of different scenarios that play out. And so I really ask folks, what plants are you trying to protect, be it your turf grass lawn or above ground trees or shrubs or edible crops, things like that.
There's grapevines.
Exactly. And you've got to pick and choose what'll work best for your given scenario. There are some efforts along the lines of biological control. Commercially, there are things like entomopathogenic or insect-killing nematodes. There's some bacterial-based products, although for some of those, the effectiveness is really pretty limited and pretty hit or miss in a lot of cases. One interesting thing that I have been watching, especially last year, is a particular fly called the winsome fly that we know will attack Japanese beetles, and it seems to be popping up a little bit more in Wisconsin.
So what do they do?
Well, the winsome fly, it's from a group, a family, the family Tachinidae. They're a little bit bigger than house flies. They have kind of a bristly appearance. And what tachinid flies tend to do is the female will lay white eggs behind the head of the insect that they're going to be attacking. And there's a bunch of different species in this group. Some attack caterpillars or other insects. Mm-hmm. But this winsome fly specifically attacks Japanese beetles. And it's really easy to identify them, even with your naked eye, because you'll see a Japanese beetle sitting on a grape leaf or another plant leaf. And then you'll look just behind the head, this big, broad kind of neck region we call pronotum. And if you see one or maybe two or three little white specks on there, those would be the eggs. And you can see that with the naked eye again. What that tells me is the winsome fly female found that adult Japanese beetle, and its days are numbered. Those eggs will hatch, the little larva or maggot will burrow inside, and that's going to be the end of the line for the Japanese beetle.
So do we have them? So we have some winsome flies in Wisconsin.
We do, and I have a colleague at the University of Minnesota who has been doing a project for a year or so looking for evidence of winsome fly in Minnesota and Wisconsin too, the upper Midwest. Many of the other reports are from kind of the eastern states where it's been established for a long time. But last year, I know colleagues at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection found them in a number of counties. I had some reports come into the diagnostic lab, and personally, my wife and I were grabbing coffee one morning in Minocqua, and we walked by the Minocqua Public Library and happened to see some on some Japanese beetles were on some plants right outside the library front door. And so that was the farthest north we've seen them in the state, which is good news, I think. Over time, that insect might potentially help kind of lower the equilibrium of Japanese beetles.
Do you think that's what's happened in, let's say, southern Wisconsin and Madison? I mean, we had this explosion and then they settled way down.
Yeah, it's possible that could be part of it, Larry. I mean, in my mind, it's probably a number of factors involved. Weather-related, natural enemies. Also, when we talk about non-native invasive species, one pattern that I tend to see is when an new pest gets to an area, I compare it to a wildfire. Very hot and damaging initially. After a while, things kind of mellow out and you're left with more of a slow smolder. And so there might be some population dynamics as well going on.
So speaking of potential explosions, last July, the elm zigzag sawflies were first detected in Wisconsin. Are you expecting them to return?
Yes. I have not personally had any reports yet this year, but they're probably out there doing their thing. This one was really interesting. It feeds specifically on elms. They'll go to American elms, Chinese, Siberian elms, and hybrids as well. And they get the name elm zigzag sawfly because the larvae will chew these very zigzaggy meandering tunnels on leaves.
Kind of cool looking tunnels. Actually.
Exactly. Very cool looking, very diagnostic. Eventually, the larvae get bigger. If you have a bunch of them ganging up on a leaf, they'll just consume the entire leaf. In some cases, and we don't fully understand why, but in some situations, they might cause a trivial amount of damage on the elm trees. In other cases, we've seen complete defoliation. And so that could really be hard on an elm tree, especially if you had like a large American elm. Maybe we've got concerns for Dutch elm disease and other issues. We have gone through the drought for a couple years. We luckily have some more moisture now. But if those elms are facing another threat, you know, that's one more thing that could put them on a slippery slope, so to speak.
Yeah. Should we be worried about getting rid of them off the trees?
Yeah, it really depends. As I said, in a lot of situations, they seem to cause a pretty small amount of damage. And so for the next couple of years, I think we're really going to have to wait and watch and see how it plays out on trees in your individual yard. There may be differences in tree species. Even within a tree species, you can have genetic variation. Some may have more defensive compounds or some other defense compared to others. And so I think we need to wait and watch. If you have a large landscape tree, there's not really any great options that you can do about it anyway. You know, if you had a really big tree, you're concerned about Dutch elm disease, you could chat with an arborist. But again, we don't know how much damage it's going to cause to your particular tree.
Yeah.
If you have, say, a small elm tree that's maybe under 10, 15 feet tall, or you recently planted one, there's going to be some options that you could do. Simple things, insecticidal soap, horticultural oils, and stuff like that. But I think we really need to wait and watch and see how much damage we will see play out in Wisconsin.
Lori emailed, this is a whole different subject, to say they have a problem with moths in her bedroom. For the past week or so, there have been 3 or 4 moths in the room, which Lori has killed. Sometimes there are as many as 8. Lori says she washed the bedroom curtains, vacuumed, and used pheromone traps, which did not catch anything. Is there anything else Lori can do to get rid of the moths? And unfortunately, she doesn't describe the moth. Okay. I wish she'd had.
Yeah, I mean, my first question in a case like this is, are we truly dealing with a moth? Because this time of the year, I see cases where a similar-looking insect called a caddisfly will sneak indoors if you have your windows open at night, and they can easily be mistaken for moths. And so I would want to rule that out. If they are moths, what type of moth are they? Are they clothing moths? Are they Indian meal moths? Are they something else? Knowing the moth species would really help crack the case, I feel, in this situation. So what I would recommend to Lori is if you are able to catch some of these. We don't want to crush them, but if you could catch some and snap some photos and send those to me, or you could put them in a little pill bottle or Tupperware and mail them into my lab, the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, then I can tell you exactly what they are. And once we identify the insect pest, in my mind, we're halfway done with the work, because now we can look up what to do about it.
PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him on to talk with us about bugs and insects. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. You can reach us at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at insects on the program today with P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you listening in today. Donald in Iron River has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Donald.
Hi, good morning. Say, I've got ash trees on my property, and half of them are all dead because of EAB, but I've got more that haven't been affected.
And so, and don't seem to be in any distress, Donald?
No, they're healthy.
Okay.
But the other ones are all dead.
Okay. And how is it that some have, your question, I guess, is how is it that some are surviving while the others are all dead, PJ?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it turns out in Wisconsin, we generally have 4 species of ash trees. Green and white are very common around towns because they've been deliberately planted as street trees, but they'll also occur in natural areas, especially along rivers. You get up north in swampy areas, there's black ash, and sometimes you can have areas that are 80-90% black ash, almost exclusively black ash. There's also blue ash, which very rare. I know there's been reported some native in some parts of southeastern Wisconsin, but otherwise that one occurs mostly elsewhere. I've in my entire life maybe seen 2-3 blue ash out there. Between all these ash species, though, there are some differences. We know blue ash, for example, does seem to have some tolerance or is not attacked and killed as readily. There's also some differences, and there's always the possibility that in a given spot, there's some genetic variation within a species that maybe gives them some ability to fight back against the insect. And so if you've seen that going on in your property, I would actually suggest maybe reaching out to the DNR. They may be interested to know that in general, we have folks going out and looking and gathering reports about surviving ash that maybe have some genetic tweak that allows them to withstand EAB, with the idea being on a long enough time scale, folks could identify those trees, maybe use them to reintroduce ash to different areas or create some hybrid that isn't killed by that insect. But again, there is some variation. If you go to places like Michigan that has had emerald ash borer longer than we have in Wisconsin, we know emerald ash borer has gone through, that wave went through, killed a lot of trees, and there's still some surviving ash.
So Donald, and so Donald should, the local DNR, he's in Iron River, so there's an office up there near
them. Yeah, I would probably start with that and just let them know that you are seeing live ash trees, because that may be of interest to folks with the DNR.
Yeah, and you could do that online or by phone. Donald, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Eagle River, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yeah, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, last fall, summer fall, I built a cabin in Amberg, Wisconsin, which is about 20 miles south of Iron Mountain on 141. And it's a brand new build, cement walls with a steel roof on top. We were inundated with beetles prior to the freeze. And they were just thick up there, thousands and thousands of them in the attic. And during the winter, many of them worked their way down, but we plugged the holes, you know, the attic scuttle hole and stuff like that. But we're kind of dreading this summer now because I think they're still up there. And we were wondering, should we bomb the attic? Some people have said don't bomb them because that's going to create food for other pests. Do we just let it happen and just keep them out of the living area? Because there's nothing in the attic. That it's just all it is space. What do we do with those? How do we solve that problem, or do we solve that problem?
And just a quick question. Can you get into the attic?
Oh, yeah. There's a scuttle, you know, just for maybe you had to get utilities or wiring or something. But for the most part, there's no usable space up there.
Yeah.
It's trusses and insulation.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so when it comes to situations like this, there are things such as the multicolored Asian lady beetle. That's the ladybug that likes to sneak into homes and other structures in the fall. There's actually quite a few other things, box elder bugs, cluster flies, and whatnot. These are insects that we often refer to as fall invaders, because in late summer, early fall, these are insects that are looking for some sheltered spot to spend the winter. Now, out in nature, they might go to a cliff face, a bluff, a rock pile, under the bark of trees, but the way that we design our structures, perfectly suitable for them. So they're coming up to the structures and that can stand out visually to them. They're looking for cracks and crevices to get in. From the insect's point of view, they want to come in, hunker down for the winter, and then leave again in the spring. And if it's those multicolored Asian lady beetles, outdoors, they can actually be beneficial in some regards, feeding on aphids and pests like that. So with that said, I really wouldn't expect them to be hanging out still in your attic, because there's no food for them there. They feed on insects on plants like aphids. So I suspect live ones would have left. You could always pop up through that access hatch and take a peek, but I'm guessing live ones have probably left. Looking at the longer time scale and bigger picture, couple of things you could do. One would be referred to as physical exclusion. This basically means sealing up your cabin nice and snug so they can't get in the first place. So looking especially at like soffit areas, if there's gaps and cracks, could you seal it up with expanding insulation foam or caulk or some other means, checking weather stripping. Although it's a new house, you should have good weather stripping on doors and windows. But looking at the exterior of the house to seal it up better, if you can do that, in theory, they shouldn't be able to get in. So that'll help you out. The other consideration, if this seems to be an ongoing issue every single year, would be to treat the exterior of your house with a residual insecticide in late summer or early fall. basically before these insects are trying to get in. You're not spraying the entire structure. You're spraying a little strip around potential entry points. So edges of siding where the wall meets the soffit overhang and places like that around doors and windows to help repel or kill them before they get in. It doesn't take much. Again, we're not broadcast spraying everything, but a little bit of repellent insecticide. You can get these for yourself at the hardware store, like a home defense type product, or you can have a pest control professional do these treatments as well.
John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Perry in Elkano, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, Larry and PJ. My question is, I have ants in the backyard, and that's where they only bother me. They leave those little ant hills, and of course, when you let your dog out in the morning, the wet dew and stuff, they run over those ant hills, and then you get mud into the or dirt in the house. So is there an easy way to eradicate the ones in the backyard? The front yard, we don't use it, so it's not a problem. And does diatomaceous earth, would that be effective to sprinkle on top?
Yeah. With ants, it depends a little bit on the species of ants involved. If you are seeing really big mounds, and these could be relatively flat, but they might be a foot across or more, or if they're actually big and mounded up, those would be a type of ant we refer to as field ants. And those can be more challenging because the nest itself can be rather deep. Sometimes it can go down 2-3 feet deep in the soil. Those are more challenging to control. If you have a situation like this, I mean, my first kind of comment about these is a lot of cases ants are beneficial. And so if they aren't sneaking into your house or causing other issues, simply tolerating them is one consideration. They can do a lot of good things out there in the environment. If it's a situation where you need to draw that line in the sand because they seem to really be tracking, you know, mud in through dog paws and things like that, probably the fastest, most direct route would be to get an ant control product you could mix up as a liquid drench and drench a bit onto each of the little mounds. That may take them out entirely or at least quiet things down for quite a while. Looking at just that part of the state, more, you know, northern parts of Wisconsin where we have sandier soil, a lot of cases ants are just going to be very common and ubiquitous because they've got soil that's easy for them to dig in. And so you're probably not going to be able to eliminate them entirely forever. But again, you could consider drenching individual mounds. The diatomaceous earth, I wouldn't expect to work very well just due to moisture outdoors.
Perry, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Maggie in Cottage Grove. Hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. How can we help you?
I, for the last 2 years, this year included, have noticed that my high bush cranberries, which I have growing wild on my property, are getting completely denuded by a very small larvae. And it's only the high bush cranberries. And I'm wondering if you know what these are.
Yeah, almost certainly this is an insect called the viburnum leaf beetle. And this is something that we first had established in the state back around 2014 over in Ozaukee, Milwaukee County area. So that's kind of the epicenter. But we did document our first case in Dane County back about 2019 or so. So I know General Madison area, Middleton, Fitchburg, Verona, Cottage Grove, these insects have a pretty strong presence. They feed on a wide range of viburnum, so that can include high bush cranberry. A lot of other plants from that plant genus as well. And what the larvae do in spring is they chew oblong holes in leaves, generally between the veins. We refer to that damage as skeletonization. And sometimes they can really cause a lot of damage, and those plants get clobbered. Sometimes with other types of viburnums, they may not be damaged quite as much. But that's almost certainly what it is. If you get out there early enough, the larvae you can control fairly easily with things like insecticidal soap, horticulture oil. Given the time of the year, though, what I would suggest is take a close look at the plants because the larvae might be gone. They go down to the soil to pupate, and if the larvae are no longer present, treating now won't really do you any good. However, once they pupate, the adults should be popping out in probably the next couple of weeks, and they can also feed and cause damage. But if you have highbush cranberry or other viburnum, and you have this insect in your ear, you're probably going to have to put up this fight every single year.
Okay, there you go, Maggie. Thank you for calling. Oscar and Stevens Point, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question about some wood that I was splitting recently. I was chopping up some pine, probably hemlock, and about an inch under the bark, I saw these markings that I can best describe to be like a gear diagram that you'd see on the top of a shifting knob if there was like 7 or 8 gears.
Yeah.
Probably about an inch wide, and I couldn't really tell what it, I asked several arborist friends of mine, and forgive the pun, they were stumped. But yeah, I was calling to see if you knew if that was an insect or potentially what type of insect that would be.
Yeah, great question. In a case like this, I'd really wonder and encourage you, if you happen to have snapped a picture, by all means, feel free to reach out and email that to me, because sometimes there are some very subtle clues, very easily could be insects. When I think of pines and other conifers that have been cut down for wood, you know, these are usually the trees that died or were dying, and so we take those ones out. There's a very long list of insects that can be underneath the bark, digging around, tunneling, causing damage. And sometimes their tunnels will be very diagnostic. The width of the tunnels, the shape of the tunnels, presence of frass or sawdust-like material is either present or absent. And so just from the description, I can't give you a very definitive answer. I can say there's a very long list of beetles and other insects that could be possibilities. But if you have a photo and can email that to me, that will probably give me some clues to help narrow it down for you.
Yeah, and the if you go to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, you will see how you can do that, Oscar. Thank you so much for calling. And Megan in Black Creek will give you a chance. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yesterday, I was weeding, and I found this really pretty caterpillar that at first I was like, is that a swallowtail? And so I Googled it, and it said it was a caterpillar for toad flax. And they feast on yellow toad flax flowers, which are a weed, which I didn't realize when I planted them from my barn over into my garden. And so I'm just curious on, like, I don't know, like, is this a native thing? Is this something that was introduced? What do we do when we find something that's potentially beneficial?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to caterpillars, we probably have a couple thousand species here in the state. And so a case like this, just like the last caller, if you happen to snap any photos and can send those to me, I'd be able to narrow down exactly which species you bumped into. Off the top of my head, I can't think of many caterpillar cases that I've had on toad flax, so I'd have to dig into some of my caterpillar books to narrow down potential species. But again, if you have photos and can Google for the search for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab and send those photos to me, I should be able to narrow it down and give you an idea. I doubt it's anything invasive. I haven't heard of anything along those lines. Probably something native that feeds on plants from that general group, but some photos would really help us out.
All right. Megan, thank you for calling. Wayne in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Wayne.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you. I've been interested in insects since I could ever remember. I have a butterfly garden sporadically around the backyard. I have butterfly weed and then the broadleaf milkweed. I think I saw one monarch last year in my yard, but I never get any caterpillars. But I do know because there's aphids that get on the milkweed, the ants are crawling up and down the milkweed, and I'm wondering if the ants are eating some of the small monarch caterpillars. I like going to monarchwatch.com. That's a really great website, and I purchase tagging kits where you can tag the monarchs. And last fall, I went to 2 nature preserves where there was a lot of milkweed, but very few monarchs. And I'm wondering what's going on. Is it people using insecticides on their landscape, or is it overspray from farmers? And then I just wanted to mention, I had a, for the first year, I had a really bad infestation of the Japanese beetle. And so what I did is, and the tree is only maybe 25 feet tall, but I got a 6-foot ladder out and I worked my way down and bumping them off the leaves into a bucket of water and soap. And I would do that at least once a day, and it, that worked really well.
Yeah, that's one direct way to get rid of them. And Wayne, you were talking about monarchs. So just to mention, at 12 o'clock, at just after noon today, we'll be talking about the Environmental Education Center in La Crosse. We'll talk about pollinators. But one of the things that they do is also they deal with monarchs and monarch watch and tagging. So that's sure to come up in the conversation at noon. So stay tuned for that. But back to the main question that he had, Wayne, PJ.
Yeah, so the ants and aphids. So first of all, aphids can be very common on milkweed. There's a couple species that can pop up. There's also aphids common on just about any plant in your yard. And there's some interesting relationships between aphids and ants. So when aphids feed, they have these needle-like mouthparts. They poke it into the plant. They drink sap. They actually are, they're drinking so much sugar they can't digest it all. So their excretions are rich in sugars. It's basically sugar water. Certain ants love that. And so there's this relationship where ants will kind of act as shepherds almost and protect the aphids in exchange for the honeydew, the sugar, as a food for the ant colony. Now, when things like this go on, ants can be kind of territorial and defensive. And so it's possible that if you had a lot of aphids and ants on a plant and you have monarch caterpillars or something else, they may be acting kind of aggressively towards caterpillars or other insects. They just don't want them in the area. So that could be a possibility. If you have a big enough patch of milkweed, you're probably going to have some aphids, but in a lot of situations, there may be enough room for both aphids and monarchs. I have seen that plenty of times myself, but it might be something to do some closer observation on this year, just to see if you happen to find any monarch caterpillars, especially if you are seeing small ones one day, and then they don't seem to be there. Possibly the ants. There are also some other insects like paper wasps that are very aggressive hunters, and they will go out and pick off caterpillar after caterpillar. So that could be part of it. The Monarch Watch website you mentioned, that is a great website. Really cool to hear about you doing the tagging. I haven't done that myself. I have friends and colleagues that have done it. Sounds like a really fun experience. But the monarchs as a whole, it's a little bit sad to think about. If you were to look at and kind of plot out their population trends over the last 30 or so years, it's definitely downwards. Part of it may be spraying, but the analogy I will make is it's like death by a thousand paper cuts. It's not one single thing. It's land use changes, agricultural practices, pesticides, just general loss of milkweed compared to 50, 100 years ago, things like that. And so we have scientists that watch their populations. They assess the overall size of the population in winter when they're all crammed together, but it has been a downward trend overall for decades. There's variability from year to year. This last winter, they were up from the previous winter, which is good news. But still, if you were to compare their numbers to 30 years ago, they're way down. So that's some sad news at the moment.
Yeah, it is indeed. I did tag one monarch, and it was kind of a cool experience to do for sure. And the larvae, the caterpillars, there are all kinds of things that can attack those monarch caterpillars when they come out. I mean, it's a tough life they've got there.
It is. Well, and if you look at the literature on monarchs, and this is going to be true of monarchs, but many other insects, there's a high mortality rate.
Yeah.
And that's just part of their strategy of life. They have a lot of offspring. A lot of those are not going to make it. I forget the exact percentage estimate for, you know, monarch eggs that make it to the adult stage, and it's like single digits.
Yeah.
So a lot of things can feed in them. There's insect predators, there's diseases, you name it.
Wayne, thank you for calling. Let's take a call from Jeff and Merrill. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Great show as usual, guys.
Thank you.
When it comes to the Japanese beetle, a lot of gardeners can get into some really heated debates about the beetle traps, the Japanese beetle traps. They work fantastic. They kill the beetles when they go in there, but are we just attracting more beetles to our property and our gardens when we hang them? And it would sure be great to get a definitive answer. Do we hang the traps, or are we doing more harm than good? Just real curious.
I'd put them over on the neighbor's yard, quite a ways away from yours, myself. But what do you think, BJ?
Yeah, I'm going to side with Larry on this one. So it's an interesting question. And I have used, years ago when I had a research appointment, I would use the Japanese beetle traps because they were very effective at collecting lots of beetles in a short period of time. So I could put them out 2 hours later, have hundreds of beetles to do experiments. That made it really easy to do. However, there are a number of research studies by folks like Dr. Dan Potter, who is at University of Kentucky, and some of his lab mates that looked at these. In some of the studies, they'd put them out in like residential yards, different heights or different distances from plants. And they were finding that you would end up getting more plant damage when the traps were present. Yes, you're going to catch beetles, but in terms of preventing damage from plants, you generally saw more damage. So I do not recommend using the traps if your thought process is, I'm going to put these out, therefore I'll reduce plant damage. The data don't back that up. It seems to cause more damage. So as Larry alluded to, you know, one thing, and there's still research going on about these traps. One possibility is if you have like a massive yard and you can put that trap very far away from the garden, could you potentially pull them away? That's a possibility. But if you have a small yard, like my yard's a quarter acre yard, I would not use them in my yard.
All right. Jeff, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking your questions, and you can join in. Have open lines get you on pretty quickly now. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just to mention, coming up at noon, we'll talk about collaboration between the Nature Place and Environmental Education Center in La Crosse and the author of a new children's book about pollinators. And then at 12:30, we'll talk about efforts to protect our northern forests with two Midwest-based members of the Nature Conservancy joining us. Right now, it's Insects with PJ Leash. Lines are filled now. So before we go to the phones, though, I did want to call attention to a photo Stacy in Broadhead emailed to say they found small black insects on their coneflowers a couple of days ago. They've never seen them before and wondering if they're a new invasive insect. Stacy didn't find them on other perennials.
Yeah, so looking at the picture, Larry, this is an orangish caterpillar, and what really stands out to me is the abundance of these black spikes on the body. And when I see caterpillars that look like that, that tells me that it's actually a type of butterfly, the family Nymphalidae. Many of those caterpillars have this very, very spiky appearance that might be a defense so that, you know, if a bird went to try and eat them, the spikes would be a deterrent. I can't quite pin down the exact species off the top of my head from the photo. It's definitely from that butterfly group. I'd probably have to sit there and compare host plants and also some of the caterpillar, the appearance in some of my caterpillar guidebooks, but definitely a type of butterfly it looks like.
So what are the black sort of spots that we're seeing there next to the caterpillar?
So that would be frass. That's a fancy word basically for bug poop. It's their excrement with bits of plant material in there.
There you go. Let's go to Brent in Wausau. Brent, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about carpenter ants. I replaced a rotten eave board maybe 10 years ago and noticed the sawdust-like material that is associated with carpenter ants. And over the last several years, I've continued to see a couple of black ants, one at a time in the kitchen or somewhere else in the house. And I'm wondering if it's possible that 10-year-old nest is still active and whether the random one-off ants that I'm seeing over and over and over again might be part of a nest from way back when.
So what does the sawdust look like? Is it really fine or?
Yeah, pretty fine. When I removed the eave board, I noticed some of that sawdust, so I sprayed inside the eave. Probably should have called a professional right then, but didn't know any better at the time.
Okay. And is this, so this is kind of by the soffit area, Brent?
Yeah, yep.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it can be a little bit hard to tell in a case like this. My first recommendation would be to do some very thorough detective work. Observe the ants that you do see when you do occasionally see them. If you're just seeing a few ants, it can be very hard to determine sometimes if there's a nest in the house or if these may be workers that are wandering in from outside, because that very feasibly could be a possibility as well, especially this time of the year. So sometimes if you can sit there for 20, 40, maybe even 60 minutes and just watch and follow the ants, that can give you some clues. The carpenter ants, like other ants, they often like to follow edges of baseboards and walls. And so if it were my house and I were seeing that, you know, all the ants seem to be going to this one particular room, one particular area, that would be a red flag to me that maybe there is something going on up there. Versus if you observe them and you conclude that they just seem to be kind of random. Other rooms, no particular pattern. It's quite possible they could be sneaking from outside. You could also go to the outside of your house and also observe, because if you have a nest in somewhere like a soffit overhang, those are often satellite colonies or satellite nests connected to a main nest outdoor somewhere. And so there could be ants occasionally going back and forth between those two, the main nest and the satellite colony. And if you can observe that, that can also give you some clues. Just keep in mind, carpenter ants, sometimes they tend to be more active after dark. So if you haven't tried it, maybe head outdoors after dark with a flashlight and just see if you notice any ant activity. I've done this in my own yard sometimes and you know, followed the ants back to a firewood pile. And if you can find that source and take care of it, that can quiet things down elsewhere.
Brent, thank you for calling. Rob in Port Edwards, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rob.
Fabulous show, gentlemen. Good job. I have two ash trees, and I don't know what flavor. However, I took a gamble. Two years ago, I did the first trimming and injections because these are large, majestic trees, and they had emerald ash borer in it. And then this year, I did the same thing. And it's pricey. They're big trees, big money for the injections. My question is, does this go on now into perpetuity? Do I have to continue every 2 years and keep retreating these trees? I'm more than willing to do it. They're great shade trees. But, you know, is there a point where the tree gets some sort of saturation where it's no longer a buffet for these grubs that get burrowed into the bark? One other quick comment quickly. That gentleman with the ants and the soffits, I had a similar problem, and I took a Sawzall and I cut open my soffit. It was a roof leak that was causing the initial issue. That's how I solved the problem, but it was an ant hotel. So if he can open up with a hole saw or something to get access to where these guys are, I bet you he's going to find a hotel Hilton.
Okay, Rob, thanks for calling. So, ash trees, Rob's spending the bucks, and every 2 years, he's injecting.
Yeah, with ash trees, there's a lot of considerations. And myself, with some colleagues in Extension, we actually have an Extension fact sheet titled along the lines of, is my ash tree worth treating for emerald ash borer? So if you were to Google that, you should be able to find it. And that can help kind of discuss the situation. Ash trees, like other trees, they can provide a lot of value, shade, cooling, things like that. In my own yard, I have one ash tree. Our biggest tree in our backyard is a big, beautiful white ash tree. Really, you know, impacts the character of our yard. If that disappeared, our yard would be very, very different. So there definitely can be a case for treating and protecting those trees. One thing that is interesting, and I have not seen a whole lot of discussion on this topic. We alluded to it a little bit earlier, where I made the comment that when a new pest gets in, it's often kind of like a wildfire. raging, very damaging initially. With emerald ash borer, it's going to go through an area and basically wipe out any susceptible ash tree for the most part, except for treated ones. What happens next at that point in the ballgame? And we don't quite know for sure in terms of what should the next steps be. We know for the trunk injection treatments for emerald ash borer, the product labels say they work for 2 years. However, I've done field experiments with this years ago and chatted with colleagues at other universities as well. We know that the trunk injection treatments that contain the ingredient emamectin benzoate, these are products like Triage and other ones, the label says 2 years. They will protect trees for 3 years, possibly even 4 years. And so there are some cities, for example, that are not treating on a 2-year rotation. They're on a 3-year plan. That allows them to stretch their budget. So that could be a consideration, is lengthening those treatment intervals. That might help us out in time. One other thing we just don't know for sure is once emerald ash borer completely goes through an area, there's probably going to be some presence around because ash trees drop a lot of seeds. There's ash seeds out in the seed bank, so to speak. Those will pop up. And we'll probably have some presence of emerald ash borer in the long run. But what does that mean for treatments? We just don't fully know at this point. But my thought is it'll probably allow us to stretch out treatment intervals. Maybe we don't have to treat every 2 years, maybe 3, 4 years, something like that. And we might shift to the mindset of watching the tree health. EAB won't kill a tree in a single year. It usually takes 3, 4, 5 years. And so if you're not treating and then you see, oh, my canopy looks a little thin, maybe you hop back on the bandwagon and treat at that point and treat for a little while, and then maybe you could pause again. But we're still trying to figure out that aspect of things.
Now, Ross in Crawford County, we'll go to you. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. Thanks, you, Wisconsin Public Radio, and all the great work you guys do. So two questions, one easy, I think, one maybe harder, I think. What would be a good summer book reading, a book that might make the insect world interesting to maybe older teenagers and adults? And then the second question is, I always, when I'm in these summer evenings and you're looking up at the sky, and every once in a while you'll see some bats, and once in a while you'll see nighthawks, I hear the whippoorwills. I'm going to throw the word out, the insect apocalypse. How are we measuring? How are the researchers measuring this quantity of insects that are kind of up in the sky that these animals are eating? And how do you measure that?
Okay, a couple things. First, books for teenagers and adults.
Yeah, gosh, for insect books, it's a little bit hard for me because there's so many good ones out there. If you have interest in a particular group of insects, say fireflies, there's certainly some good ones along those lines. One book that has been out for years and really probably a couple decades at this point by Thomas Eisner is For Love of Insects. And that's a good read. So I'd certainly mention that one. Also, I would say the scientist Bernd Heinrich, he has a couple of books, one called Summer World, one called Winter World, and it's not specific to insects. It talks about wildlife in general, but a lot of his research and expertise is in insect biology, and so those creatures pop up again and again in those books. So any of the books by Bernd Heinrich, like Summer World, Winter World, and so on, those would be some good summer reads as well.
Got about 20 seconds for the
for the insect apocalypse. It's hard to measure, and scientists are still trying to figure out the best way to measure things. And it's interesting with AI and technology, we'll probably get even better ways, but there's no one single best answer in terms of how to most accurately count insects.
And there's a new book about children's book about pollinators we'll be talking about coming up. But PJ, in the meantime, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And you can go to the lab. If you've got a photo or something you want to send to him, UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you got all the information on how to send it. Coming up, we'll be talking about the Nature Place Center in La Crosse and environmental education. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News, turning our attention to a place called the Nature Place. A La Crosse area author has teamed up with environmental education center to teach kids about pollinators, the bugs and birds that spread pollen and make our flowers bloom. And we're talking about the center now for the next half hour with our guests. Stephanie Hanna is Community Programs Manager for the Nature Place. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Larry. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, great to have you here. Also with us, Nick Nichols, a retired sustainability coordinator for La Crosse County and author of the new children's book. It's called Pollinator Parade. And Nick Nichols, welcome to you as well.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. Longtime listener.
Oh, great to have you with us. Just to mention, at 12:30, we'll talk about efforts to improve the health of the Northwoods with Matt Dahlman and Laura Slavsky. But right now, what do you or your kids know about pollinators? You want to get involved in a community science project, maybe. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Stephanie, maybe we can start with you. Tell us about the Nature Place in La Crosse.
Sure. The Nature Place is basically a nature-focused community center. So we are located in Myrick Park and right by the 800-acre Hickson Forest and 1,100-acre La Crosse River Marsh. So it's a beautiful setting we have here for the Nature Place. And our mission is to inspire and cultivate connections between people and nature. And we hope that we can do that for the benefit of both.
Yeah, and it's and they get a variety of experiences, folks do.
Yeah, we offer all kinds of different programs. Some have a fee, some are free. And we try to do programs for all ages. For example, this evening, we have a partnership with the Coulee Region Audubon Society, and we have a meeting for adults to join the society, be part of the birding community. We also have a partner program that we do for kids on the first Saturday, kids and families, the first Saturday of the month. We call it Nature Saturday at the Nature Place, and we have some of our live animals that we bring out. So we really try to work with different partners and to offer all kinds of experiences.
And in my recollection, if I'm not mistaken, the Nature Place is modeled after the Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee, is it not?
That is correct. That was the basis for our change, which happened a few years ago. We wanted to do something very similar to what Ken Leinbach, who's the executive director there, or who was the executive director there, and what he wrote about in his book, The Urban Ecology. We wanted to have a center that was a place where people could go. I believe they coined the term nature's living room. So it's or your other living room. It's like a place where you can go and hang out. So you can come just hang out, do programs, or you can sit. There's a beautiful fireplace area. There's an area where families can play games, and there's an area for toddlers. So what we tried to do was make it a visitor center and an environmental education center and a place for the community.
Well, I want to turn to Nick for a minute, too, because Nick, in collaboration, I guess, with the Nature Place, you've authored a children's book titled Pollinator Parade. Tell us about the book and maybe how it'll help the Nature Place.
Well, the book is geared towards elementary school age kids. It's a simple story about a couple of kids who go visit their grandma and grandpa, and they learn all about the pollinators and the pollinator garden that grandma and grandpa are putting together. And it's not that they don't know about them, but it's a real expansion of that knowledge. I mean, most people don't understand that it's more than just bees and butterflies. I mean, it's flies and wasps and moths and ants and beetles and just all kinds of different things. And so the book is just geared towards getting kids more involved and teaching them that even little things can make a big difference as far as helping our pollinators out.
Yeah. And Nick, you've got some background there. You were, I think you were a sustainability coordinator. Did I imagine that played a role in what you've done?
Absolutely. When you deal in sustainability, one of the real things that you understand is how sustainability means money. It's economic. I mean, when you're talking about pollinators, pollinators contribute over $19 billion worth of economic impact in the United States. And that's just bees. All pollinators, it's over $34 billion. Worldwide, it's between $235 and $577 billion. So it's important that we help these creatures keep going because they mean a lot to our economy.
Absolutely. Linda in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for letting me speak.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to recognize that I read the book, and the illustrator is Peter Hodapp, who lives in Barocco, who's been an artist for 30 years or longer, and has been illustrating his entire career, done murals in Madison, done a lot of other artwork in our community and in the state of Wisconsin. And he did all the illustrating. And when I was speaking with him, he was sharing how every bug had to be very specifically done exactly to what the bug was to look like, and had like 8 different people assessing it, scientists and other professionals, to make it exactly how it's supposed to be. So he did all the illustrating, the children, the grandparents, the bugs, and everything. So I wanted to mention Peter Hodapp.
All right. Thank you, Linda, very much. Comments there, Mark? Nick, I'm sorry?
Oh, I tell you, this book couldn't have been done without Pete, let me tell you, and without all of our partners, too. We partnered with several UW lacrosse students, of the Turbo professor. We wanted to make this as scientifically accurate as possible. So the creatures that are in it, the insects, the flowers, everything, it's all absolutely accurate, especially to this area. So a big shout out to everybody who's a part of this collaboration.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I could add to that, too, the fact that I have been an educator and a biologist for a long time, and that's one of the things that I've always been really concerned about is, you know, you have to have the correct biology and the correct information for these education purposes. And we were really lucky to have some UWL master students of entomology and professors. And and then Pete took all that information and made it into a really good presentation.
You know, I suspect that it's not only young kids that'll learned something from the book.
Well, and that's part of the hope, too. It's actually done in almost a graphic novel format. So we're hoping to appeal to a little older kids, but then, of course, parents as well. And the idea is to try and get those kids out to do something. At the very end of the book, we show the grandkids walking away with flowers and talking about how they can help pollinators in their home. So that's kind of the goal here.
Oh, that's great. Stephanie Hanna, who is the community program manager for the Nature Place and La Crosse, and Nick Nichols, retired sustainability coordinator for La Crosse County and the author of the book Pollinator Parade. You can join in again. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I said, you know, in late April, the Nature Place lost some federal funding for something like 14 AmeriCorps staff members. How does that affect the work that you do?
Well, we were impacted by that cut. We were happy to see that there was an injunction on June 5th. And that is good news. We're still trying to sort out, you know, what it will allow us to do and not do. We definitely have had to make changes. We haven't been able to get all our AmeriCorps members back, but we are working on figuring all this out to make it a great summer experience The most important thing right now is our summer day camps. We have over 600 kids that come to our summer day camps, ages 3 to 12, and we want to make sure that they get a good experience.
Yeah, that's a lot of children, and having had some experience in the past with summer programs, I can tell you it takes a lot of help, a lot of volunteers, and of course, professional staff as well.
Yeah, we do make sure that all of our programs with the kids have a teacher and an assistant with all the time. We try to get them outdoors as much as possible, right? That's the point of what we do here and connect with nature. And we have a really good time and really enjoy doing that.
So the book, by the way, somebody's already asked, well, how's the book available?
Well, you can get it through the Nature Place. Go to, I believe Steph has the address there, but go to thenatureplace.org, and there's a link there where you can actually order the book or stop in at the Nature Place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's the cost of the book?
The book is $10 a piece. Of course, we'll take any additional donations. Remember that the Nature Place is a nonprofit organization, and that was certainly the goal of the book. All the profits go to the Nature Place and Operation Pollination.
Yeah, so natureplacelacrosse.org/whatwedo/pollinatorparade, or if all else fails, obviously, just Google the Nature Place, and you'll be able to figure out how to go to the spot on the website to order the book.
Yeah. The community science programs that you offer are really kind of cool. I was looking at the Driftless Area BioBlitz online, and I thought, well, this is a cool thing. Talk about that a bit, too. It's something that you do.
Yes, that was actually started by another amazing supporter who also helped with this book. Her name is Vicki Miller. She is a supporter and volunteer at the Nature Place and a lot of other places, too. She's been involved in this kind of environmental education for quite a while. And so she was outside in her garden and she started looking at everything and she thought, well, there's a lot out here. And how do I, you know, find out what these things are? She found out about the app iNaturalist. And then she thought, well, what about having people get together to observe and learn and classify and identify using this app everything that they find. So what we've done is we've created in the Driftless area, we've created a series of five programs, and they're all free for families or people of any age, really. And we get an expert to explain a little bit. For example, last Saturday, we talked about prairie plants. We were out at a local conservancy land, and we were out there looking at prairie plants. We had someone talk about prairie plants. Then we explored and identified and uploaded to our project on iNaturalist.
And so what did you upload? Just the species, or?
We uploaded the species that we found of prairie plants, but also anything else that was interesting. Insects. And what happens is everything gets downloaded to the project, the specific project for the Driftless Area BioBlitz. And then people can go back and look, hey, I found that. Here's what I identified and here's what I found. And the information does actually get used for science.
I would think that there'd be quite a database if you got a lot of people out there collecting that citizen science project.
Yes, there was quite, we had about 30 people out there, and we did identify hundreds of different things. So we did do a lot.
Yeah, that is very cool. And I wanted to mention another one, just because we were just talking about insects with Phil, with PJ Leash, and a fellow called about monarchs. And I was remembering that you also have a Monarch Watch program as well.
Yeah, we're part of the Monarch Watch program. Mostly my coworker, Cindy Blobaum, who's our environmental education manager. She will teach people who are interested how to actually catch a monarch, carefully catch it, and tag it, and then enter the information from that tag into the database, and then people can actually find out how their monarch did. Did it make it to Mexico? What happened? So we are very much involved with that program as well.
I thought that was very cool and something, well, not quite similar. You're not tagging toads and frogs, but there is a program with that, and talk about that program. These are some really cool programs.
Yes, we do the frog call survey with, again, it's a lot about collaborating with different groups in our area and with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We do have a time, I believe it's in April, and there's another couple times coming up that is determined to be the time to go out, the best time to go out and listen for frogs. And so we partner with the La Crosse, Friends of the La Crosse River Marsh, and we go out and do that a few times a year. Frogs call when they are looking for mates. It's the males that call. And then that information is downloaded again into the Department of Natural Resources database by our partners, the Friends of the La Crosse River Marsh. Families can come and join, and it's usually done in the evening as the sun sets.
So that's very, very cool. You know, I'm just thinking about the nature place. It sounds like it's a busy place pretty much the year round, or am I wrong? I know it's busy in the spring and summer for sure.
It's certainly busy in spring, summer, and fall. So as I said, it's a lot of summer day camps going on right now. That's where a lot of our programs are happening. We also do, of course, field trips for schools in the spring and in the fall. And we do field trips in the winter as well. We try to do programs for families in the winter as well. One of the programs that I started this year was Fireside Stories. So we had different guest storytellers come in and tell a story by the fireplace, and families came and listened to the story. And then we had an activity related to the story. And of course, if the weather cooperated, we could go outside and explore looking for animal tracks, other signs of animals in winter.
Oh, man. Nick, back to you for a minute. First, do you get involved in any of these other activities?
I haven't been involved in a lot of them, but my grandkids have. and with all the programs and projects these guys are doing, how can you not support that? You know, they do a fantastic job, and especially over the course of the summer when kids are at home and parents really need a break.
Yeah. Tell us, you know, as we're closer to the end of our time here, but I want to go back to the book because I think it'd be important to, again, describe the book and how people can get copies and then what it means for the center itself.
Oh, go ahead.
So they can contact us, natureplacelacrosse.org. /whatwedo/pollinator parade. And we are hoping that we will be able to get some profits from the book that will go back into our environmental education and our summer programs and our community programs. Because, of course, the community programs that are free are not really free. They are free because we have support from other organizations and from folks who help us by buying this book and or coming to our other programs renting our facility is also a really good way to support the nature place.
Yeah. And Pollinator Parade, just give us a quick thumbnail again of, I think it's a pretty cool book, but there may be people who tuned in late.
Oh, it's a wonderful children's picture book that's geared towards mostly elementary, but also middle school kids. And it's done in kind of a graphic format, graphic comic book format. About a couple of kids who go visit grandma and grandpa and discover all the wonderful different pollinators there are and how they operate and what they do and how they can actually make a difference in their own homes or in their own neighborhood by planting a few plants here and there and helping the pollinators.
And just to stress again, the insects and the pollinators we see are very accurately drawn.
Everything is scientifically accurate, and because of our artist, Pete Hodapp, they're very good renderings of actual plants and insects, and all the profits go to the Nature Place and Operation Pollination. So it's a great fundraiser for them and a little way for me to participate.
Pretty good use of $10, I think.
Absolutely. And, or more.
Or more. Yeah, $10 or more. And if you go to the Nature Place, again, what's the website once more?
It's natureplacelacrosse.org.
/. Oh, yeah. They'll never remember the forward slash part. Nature.
So just natureplace.org or just Google us, the Nature Place. We're located on the west coast of Wisconsin, right by the beautiful Mississippi River and the La Crosse River.
It's a beautiful, beautiful area. And I want to thank you both for taking some time to be with us today and talk about the book and talk about the Nature Place. It sounds like there's always a lot going on there. I know there's some financial issues with some of the funding, potential funding cuts and actual funding cuts. And let's hope you can keep her going as strong as it's always been. I appreciate it very much, Stephanie and Nick. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Stephanie Hanna is the Community Program Manager for the Nature Place. It's an urban ecology and environmental education center in La Crosse. Nick Nichols, retired sustainability coordinator for La Crosse County, and he's the author of that new children's book titled Pollinators Parade. And I'll guarantee you the adults will learn something from that book as well. We all will. Coming up, we're going to take a look at resources, resilience. Let's call it resilience in the North Woods with our forest lad. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. You know, the North Woods, think about the North Woods. It spans millions of acres. If you think about across Wisconsin, across Minnesota, northern Minnesota, across Michigan. So there's a lot of land there and a lot of trees. But those forests, all of them actually, are facing some increasing threats. Climate change comes to mind. I'm sure development can play a role as well. And we're going to talk now about some efforts to make our northern forests more resilient to environmental stress. And we have a couple of guests for you. Matt Dahlman, one of them, the Nature Conservancy's strategy director for the North Woods. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Larry. Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Also with us, Laura Slavsky, a resilience forester for the Nature Conservancy. And Laura, great to have you with us, too. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And both of our guests, of course, are based in northern Wisconsin. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. You spend some time in the North Woods. I do. I love it there. You wonder about the impact of logging and maybe climate change on the forests in our upper Midwest? Give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Matt, let's start with you. We often refer to that forested region of the upper Midwest, including Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan, as the North Woods. How do you define the North Woods?
Well, Larry, I think it goes back to, you know, childhood memories of, you know, large trees and wild lakes and rivers across North Woods, eagles and bears and deer. So that's, to me, like what the North Woods is. But my role at the Nature Conservancy now has me working across that entire region that you're talking about, 60 million acres that we define as the North Woods. And it is really diverse. It's a place for plants and animals, and it's also really important for people, not only in the services and the function that forests play, but also in the jobs and the economy that it supports Wisconsin and the upper Midwest.
And we're talking about, how many million acres are we talking about, do you think?
Yeah, so we've actually done that on a map and GIS that out, and it's about 60 million acres of forest lands in northern Michigan, across the Upper Peninsula, northern Wisconsin, into Minnesota. So it's a vast area.
Yeah, I think we've got something like 17 million acres of it in Wisconsin itself, yeah. Let alone the other ones. So talk about your organization, the Nature Conservancy. What's it doing to protect the northern forest?
Hey, Larry, I'm going to start, and then I'm going to pass it to my colleague, Laura, to talk a bit more about what we're doing on the ground. But just to kick things off a little bit, you know, the Nature Conservancy is a global conservation organization. We're working in over 70 countries now also, but we have really strong programs in all 50 states. In the North Woods and the work that we're doing here, it's really about looking forward and making sure that the forests that we have and generations have today will have those type of same forests to enjoy and recreate in, and the services that they provide. So if you think of forests, pretty important to human life. They when they grow, they're producing oxygen. When water and rain falls on them, and they're filtering our rainwater. So headwaters to the Great Lakes, headwaters to the Mississippi, creating oxygen. You know, they're also, you know, helping us cool, you know, in warmer climates. You know, in cities, our trees are helping really cool the climates in cities. So it's important, the function that they play. They help mitigate climate change. You know, they're pulling carbon dioxide in and storing and sequestering that carbon from the atmosphere. They're habitat for wildlife. And, you know, studies even showing that they're good for people's mental and physical health. So the Conservancy is really interested in making sure that we're taking the science that we're understanding and putting it into practice on the ground so that we can do what we can to incrementally make our forests more resilient. And with that, I would pass that to my colleague, Laura, to talk a little bit more about what we're doing there.
And Laura, your title, I think, is you're a resilient forester, and just start with what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, my job title is resilience forester. And I think at its most basic, resilience to me means being able to adapt to change and kind of think about what's coming. So both with the work I do of what we're doing on the ground and in forests, we're kind of thinking about what's going to happen to these forests, what stressors and threats do they face, and what can we do about it now? And then we're trying to make forests more resilient. So being able to handle what's coming, drier temperatures, warmer temperatures, heavier storms, all of the above.
How resilient are they, our forests?
That's a great question. I mean, I would say they have some resilience now, and then we have the ability to help make them even more resilient. I think over time, maybe, well, not all of our forests, but some of our forests have become a little more simplified, at least in the number of species or the age of the trees. And we know that having diverse age classes, species, cover types, all of the above can benefit all of what Matt was just talking about, habitat, water quality, and just make more resilient forests.
Yeah, well, how do you manage that? I mean, how can the forest be managed to withstand some of the things you're talking about?
Yeah, so the team I work on, we do a lot of tree planting and then tending through establishment, meaning helping the trees grow tall so that they can be a seed source for future forests. So a big part of that is helping the trees not get eaten by deer and other animals. And then we also will go and try to help keep other plant competition away from the planted trees. So it'll be cutting around the planted trees for a period of time until they're tall and able to compete on their own, just to get a good species mix. And yeah, those are the kind of the main things that we're working on, which I can go into detail about too, but that's kind of the broad level overview of it.
It would be interesting to, I mean, you're taking, where are you getting the seed and so forth from? And then I understand, or I think I understand, that some of it comes from a little further south and to be planted in the north.
Yes. Yeah. So we work with a lot of different land agencies, a lot of public land agencies on my team, and each group has their own goals of moving things from south to north. Some are further along than others in their official plans. But each year we're planting trees from anywhere from, I don't know, 50 to up to 200 miles south and planting them north. Almost all of them to date have been species that currently grow up in the areas we're planting. So it's not moving new species up, but it's taking genetics from the same species that are on the further end of their distribution. And those ones have genetics that will help them be able to withstand warmer temperatures, drier summers, et cetera.
I'm thinking about all that land, and I don't know how many people you have to make a huge impact, but I mean, what's your progress, let's say, in the course of a year? How many plants might be, or seeds might be sown, or plants might be planted?
Yeah, well, we actually just finished our tree planting season for this year last Tuesday, and we were able to plant 2.5 million trees, just over 2.5 million.
Wow.
And to date, that means we, since 2005, have planted over 13 million trees. And that's the team I work on. There's other teams within the Northwoods that are also doing tree planting, so I'm not sure what the total number would be across the Northwoods.
That's quite an achievement, man.
Yeah, it's a lot of trees. It's a lot of coordination and planning, and that's kind of the bread and butter of the work I do, is getting all of that figured out and planned. I mean, along with all of my teammates, and getting our contracts ready, and yeah, working with partners, identifying sites. Just it's a lot to kind of wrap your head around when you hear a big number like that, to know what that actually looks like, means, and kind of how that gets done on the ground.
Especially when it's intentional planting. I mean, you were mentioning sites and so forth. You just don't go run out to the woods and plant a tree.
Absolutely, yeah. That's maybe it's a 2-year head start for getting seeds to then be trees ready to plant, and then it's roughly a year for getting sites and figuring out all the rest of the details of what gets a tree planted. And then we're looking beyond just planting the trees. We're trying to keep them alive through getting established, so keeping them away from deer browse and getting the competition cut. All of that goes into it. So it's not just planting. We're going back every year on thousands and thousands of acres to tend these trees.
Man. Well, Matt, the Nature Conservancy owns about, I don't remember the exact acreage, over 100,000 acres of Northwoods in across the three states we were talking, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Is that right? And I'm wondering what you do with the land, too.
Yeah, so in the north, so we own about that in the three states. In Wisconsin, total, in the state of Wisconsin, we have just over 30,000 acres. A lot of that is in the Bearable Hills area. We're doing a lot of forest work and making sure that we can perpetuate the oak forests that were down there and really driven by fires. In the north, we have a property called Carolyn Lake in Ashland County that has been our test site for climate resilience type of work, where we're looking at what the forest used to be and then using the latest science to project forward. Like, what, instead of looking back at the 1800s and that old forest, we're looking at what science is telling us that the future forest will be. And we're incrementally managing those lands, creating larger canopy gaps, planting some long-lived conifer tree species like white pine in there, promoting oak species. So we're moving that forest from what used to be probably more of a maple forest into something that's eventually, you know, years down the road, generations down the road, more into oak and pine to be more resilient for what science is telling us that climate will be in the future. So we're doing management like that. We also have properties where we're essentially are just watching as a control, like what is nature doing on its own, so that we can have that as a baseline to figure out where things aren't being manipulated. What could we be doing? So we want that control area too, as well as these places that we're incrementally moving towards a path, a more resilient future.
Thinking about the past, it sort of came up a little bit of history. A comment reminded me or made me think about the back in the day, the real history when the European settlers cleared land for farming and so forth. I mean, think about the size of the forest at one point in our state and where it is now. I mean, there's less now, I'm assuming.
We actually, in Wisconsin, we actually have more forests now than we had back in like 1950, because some of those forests are growing. You think about the people that tried to settle and farm the north. The soils weren't great. The climate wasn't too suitable for growing agricultural crops, and a lot of those just got kind of grown back into forests. But as Laura said earlier, our forests are really simplified from what that system used to be, both in the age classes that were out there. We used to have pretty abundant forests that were in the 200 plus year old range, and that has really been reduced to only a small fraction of our landscape. And then when we cut the forests that grew back were simplified. Deer were a big driver in that because they love to eat species like our oaks and our pines. And when we have that type of browse pressure, we just get quick growing trees coming up. And when you look in the future, a lot of those quick growing trees may not be the most resilient for that future climate. So yeah, our forests are really different. And it's pretty amazing the impact that we had in such a short amount of time across the entire Northwoods, from essentially the East Coast all the way across to the Great Lakes.
Our guest today, Matt Dahlman, Nature Conservancy Strategy Director for the Northwoods, based in northern Wisconsin. Laura Slavsky is the Resilience Forester for the Nature Conservancy. It's great to have both of them with us. Questions, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the resiliency of our forest land, our northern forests, today with our two guests, Matt Dahlman and Laura Slavsky from the Nature Conservancy. It's great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Trudy in Milwaukee. Trudy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. It's great to talk to you in real time.
Great to have you with us. What's on your mind?
Well, I love this conversation, as I do most conversations on your show, and I just wanted to ask your guests about, I've been really inspired this year by what I've been learning about what the Menominee tribe here in Wisconsin is doing in sustainable forestry on their reservation, with burning, diverse tree age planting, and just maintaining their forests over time. So I'm just curious what sort of inspiration or opportunities do the guests to collaborate with Native nations on resilient forests.
Oh, all right. Trudy, thanks for calling. Matt, turn to you for that.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. I would say that the Menominee example of the way that they manage their lands has been kind of the gold star for how we all kind of look and approach it. It's about how do we remove what essentially nature is asking us to remove and leave the rest and let it grow healthy and strong. You know, that is an amazing place. If people have had the opportunity to drive through the reservation, you just know when you're there. You could just because of the volume of trees. And that's probably a lot of what northern Wisconsin looked like, and kind of the image in which we want to shoot for when we think about restoring our forests. So growing more and larger trees and making sure that they're healthy. So we have had programs within the Conservancy, and I know other agencies across the state have looked to the way that they manage and their advice to really influence sustainable forestry across the other management in with other ownerships.
Yeah. And Trudy, thank you again for calling. Let's take a call from Sarah in Lake Villa, Illinois. Sarah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi. Thank you, too. I'm curious what new pests and diseases that native trees are going to have to deal with.
In that region. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah.
Well, Laura, you want to take that?
Yeah. Let's see. So, as far as I know, there maybe aren't too many brand new pests in the region. There's several non-native and native pests. So, for example, in northern Minnesota, spruce budworm has had quite an impact, as well as in Michigan and Wisconsin, I believe. And that's a native pest that has natural cycles, and it happens to be at its peak of its cycle right now in a lot of areas. I know emerald ash borer is a relatively big concern in Minnesota and Michigan. And that's been making its way through. That's an invasive species. Matt, I don't know if you have others. I mean, there's a huge list of species that impact trees.
Yeah, I would just add a little bit. If you look at, you know, Larry, you asked a question earlier about do we have less forest now than before? Our forests have taken a little bit of a decline in the last years, and it's primarily due to emerald ash borer. Wisconsin has something like 740 million ash trees, and if anybody has driven the state, especially up like Highway 41 or east of Green Bay, there is a lot of ash areas that have completely been decimated by emerald ash borer, and it's eventually moving across the state. So that's probably our most impactful and visible. One that's knocking on the door that we should all be aware of, especially for people that like the camp in the north woods and love the large hemlock trees, is hemlock woolly adelgid. It's on the western side of Lake Michigan and the state of Michigan. It hasn't crossed into the UP yet, but it's just probably a matter of time. It's white and fluffy, and it essentially pulls the fluids out of a tree and kills it. In eastern U.S., it's had big impacts, and we need to watch and keep track of that one. That will have major impacts, kind of as obvious as the emerald ash borer, if that gets into Wisconsin. So we need to tackle that as soon as we can, or as soon as we see it. So,
yeah, there's never seems to be a shortage of things that can cause that kind of damage. I'm wondering, you mentioned lumbering earlier too, and do you work with, or maybe how do you work with lumber companies, the Nature Conservancy?
Yeah, Larry, I have another hat that is the vice chair of the Wisconsin Council on Forestry, and it's interesting when I talk to my colleagues across all three states, we have a similar a concern, and that concern is the changing of our forest industry in the area, because for years we've been able to utilize, you know, pulp, a strong pulp market to be able to incrementally manage our lands and then sell those forest products and then use that proceeds to go back into restoration work. So really use forest management to build healthy forests. So that type of forest products industry is really important to make sure that we can manage and address issues. We're seeing larger storm events, and we need to be able to go in there and pick up after those events. When we have these pests and pathogen outbreaks, we need to go in there. And industry has been allowing us to be able to have markets for that wood. And without it, it's a big concern of whether we can keep up with the multiple threats that our forests are facing. So strong industry is a good way to build in, help us build a resilient forest too.
It's a big deal for sure. I'm wondering, we talked a little, Matt, about the land that the Conservancy owns itself. But how does the Nature Conservancy help manage public lands that it may not own at all?
Yeah, I'm going to pass that to Laura because a lot of her work is landing on public lands.
Yeah, okay, that's great, Laura. Go ahead.
Yeah, so in Minnesota, the Nature Conservancy is working a lot with public landowners, so national forests, DNR lands, and county-owned lands. So of those 2.5 million trees I mentioned earlier that got planted, all of them were planted on public lands. So we work very heavily with all of our partners to identify areas where we want to get work done, and then getting the funding to do that work, and just this back and forth collaboration to be able to do management. And it's a way to help our partners be able to do even more than they're doing. So they have their own work that they're working on, and we are able to kind of help put it one step further across, well, in the case of Minnesota, across the whole Arrowhead pretty much.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund, which I think is... you know, Wisconsin's used millions of dollars through that Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund to buy and conserve forest land. There's been some talk about cutting back on that funding, but I mean, how has that really assisted you folks?
Yeah, the Conservancy in Wisconsin has utilized Knowles-Nelson pretty good, or pretty regularly. They other land trusts in the state of Wisconsin have also been good, you know, big recipients of that program too. From our perspective, we've over the years we've helped. So we may only own 30,000 acres in the state, but over the years we've helped protect over 140,000 acres. A lot of that land has been protected through working forest conservation easements, and typically that is like federal dollars matched with state Knowles-Nelson money to be able to make those projects happen. And what the outcome of those projects are: maintaining public access, maintaining sustainable timber rights to it, and keeping those lands undeveloped, so you know, the way they are now. So the program has been critical in leveraging other funds. And when you think about the investment of state dollars from a conservation standpoint, we're bringing 50% of those funds to the table and matching it with the state's investment. So it's a really good deal for conservation in the end, because we're doubling the pot of money and it's leveraging a lot of good conservation. So it's led to protecting most of the timberlands that I'm aware of that we own in the north, and about 360,000 acres of working forest easement across the north too, and across the state. So there's been other working forest easements in Baraboo and southeast Wisconsin also.
Yeah. I'm wondering about the kinds of conservation help that you receive in the form of volunteers. I mean, do you work with volunteers? I would assume you do.
Yeah, if we counted all the free hours we get from volunteers and the work that they do to pull weeds and prep places and keep trails open for people to access their lands and enjoy them, it's pretty amazing. It's a great network of people across the state, and all the states that we work have this foundational group of supporters that make our work possible, essentially. So it's also not only in the donation of their time and the work on the ground, but it's their dollars that they give that really makes the work that Laura and I do possible. Because as much public funding as we can get, it really also is dependent upon bringing in some private funds to match a lot of those funding sources too.
Yeah. And so, Laura, how will the average citizen help you and help keep our forests healthy and safe?
Yeah, a lot of the work we're doing is at a pretty big scale, and so it's through a lot of different contracts with people, but our chapter, and probably every chapter of the Nature Conservancy, has volunteer opportunities for planting, maintenance, working on preserves, all sorts of different projects. So anyone who's interested in helping out can go to nature.org and look up more information. You can look by state, region, and kind of just see what's up out there. And yeah, depending on the season, there's lots of different things people can help with.
And here we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for talking with us today, Matt and Laura. It's been a pleasure, and we'll hopefully be doing this again down the road. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thank you.
Matt Dahlman is the Nature Conservancy Strategy Director for the Northwoods. Laura Slavsky is the Resilience Forester for the Nature Conservancy. Great to have them with us, and we'll talk more about that as we go along today. And thank you so much for listening today. Shows are always a team effort, and we've got producers like Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, and we have two technical directors. Lee Rayburn's with me today, but Jeff Robbins also is involved, of course, and our executive producers, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.